course, it had to fade, didn't it? Welcome to the Minefield. Tell you what, when it rains, it pours. It's taken me forever to try to get some Pink Floyd on this show, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, Scott decides he's a fan, and it's turning up every second week. That, of course, is Pink Floyd's Money from Dark Side of the Moon, the greatest album ever released. I will hear no argument to the contrary. This is not a music show, although when I hear that, I think it probably should be. We are trying to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. And today's topic, well, it obviously has to do with money, but it's not just about money. I think it's about one of the most fundamental structural changes or realignments in society that... is it for the best or not? I'd certainly have a lot of suspicions, but then I'm suspicious of everything. Well, Lee Daly is my name. Scott Stevens is my slightly less suspicious co-host.
Oh, slightly less suspicious? Good heavens. Well, see, I have this thing, Waleed. It's a private bet that if I want to be sure that you enter the show with a really good mood and we really extract the best of you from a conversation, start the show with Pink Floyd. That's kind of my... It's completely cynical.
Oh, that's not true. You're just trying to pretend that you haven't seen the light.
Well, I'm still not quite the fan of Dark Side of the Moon. But anyway. Right. The song is fabulous. And can I say, wearing earphones, I'm hoping that our listeners are listening to this with earphones on, because just having the interplay back and forth from left to right, it's actually a little bit intoxicating.
Oh, yes. And what is it? The music concrète, I think is what they call
nice.
It.
Nice.
They build the cash register out of, was it, pouring coins in bowls.
That's
and all
right.
sorts of stuff. It's
good.
Incredible.
There you are.
Incredible piece of work. So anyway, I suppose we better talk about something else.
Structural changes. Well, in fact, it is just about money. And here I completely disagree with you. Everything about this topic is fundamentally about money, because it seems to me that we are now witnessing, under the guise of what's often called digital disruption, we are seeing capitalism's most perfectly realized form. If you accept, as I do, and I'm not sure that you would, Waleed, that you can't have capitalism without the exploitation of workers, that the center, the logical heart of capitalism as such is the driving down of the value of wage labor, then what we've been witnessing over the last few years, under the guise of what's sometimes called the gig economy, or what's often even referred to as the Uberization of work. I actually quite like that, the Uberization of work.
Except that it does give an ad.
It does give an ad. Yes, but a really derogatory ad, which is the kind of ad that I don't
doesn't
quite...
matter.
Okay.
Doesn't
anyway,
matter.
There
there's
we
a
are.
Reason there's a reason that fast food companies don't mention their competition.
That is true. That
in
is
their
true.
Ad, in, yeah.
So we're sticking with gig economy, are we?
you do what you want.
Okay.
I'll just call hypocrisy if you decide to call it something.
So this is what we're looking at. We've seen this radical realignment, I think, of the relationship between customers and the services that various workers provide. This is also sometimes, and actually, come to think of it, it's not the Uberization of work that I think is probably the best description. It really is platform capitalism that we're witnessing emerging at the moment, where these digital companies, and they really are platforms that exist not because they own assets as such or because they provide a particular service, but because they exist as mechanisms, as mediums by which customers and service providers can be placed in contact with one another. The idea is you want something done, you want to go from A to B, you want something done, I've got a clicking ceiling fan and I need someone to come around and fix it. You want something done, you don't have to go through an agency, you don't have to sort of get in contact with a company, you can go directly to someone who's willing to provide that particular service. So the crucial thing about platform capitalism is that they are asset light. They don't own very much except for the digital infrastructure. What they do is they place customers and service providers in contact with one another in a way that's incredibly convenient for the customer, in a way that's incredibly flexible. This is the part of the sales pitch, flexible for the worker, and in a way that drives costs much, much lower, especially for the customer.
Can I ask you, though, before
yes.
we proceed, would you put a company like Microsoft in that category?
I don't see how you couldn't, because it's easy to talk about, say, the tech startups, you know, things like AirTask or Deliveroo or Airbnb or even these days Uber. But you'd also have to include, I think, in this something like Microsoft, but also Amazon. I mean, the whole idea is you have these enormous digital infrastructures that exist for the convenience of customers, or purportedly exist for the convenience of customers, but the logic, the way in which these, the way in which the service is provided to the customer, is in the promise that it's going to be convenient, but also it'll be much cheaper than any other rival.
Okay. So I don't mean to stop your stop where you're going, but I do think you're conflating things here that are not the same thing. So the reason I asked the Microsoft question is particularly that because of a Zygmunt Bauman comment that he made about the changing nature of capitalism and about how capitalists of the past, the industrialists of the past, cared about their assets. They cared about the factories that they owned and the buildings and the trucks and whatever it was that they owned. But what one of the features of liquid modernity is that people don't really care for their assets because they make money kind of out of thin air.
Yeah.
And he gives the example of Bill Gates. Bill Gates cares a lot less about the specific assets that he owns than, say, the Rockefellers did, right? So that's one way of looking at it. But I actually think the gig economy is a very different thing. It may exist in a continuity, but we're talking about something different, which is really about the commodification of errands, if you like.
Yes.
Microsoft isn't selling convenience per se, I wouldn't have thought. What it's selling is tools, really. If you get access to word processing, for example, that is a tool that you can, it's a thing that you can use as you need to for the sake of accomplishing various tasks probably in your work life. That's very different to, I need someone to go pick up an ironing board from me who's prepared to do it for money. What that is the commodification of more or less menial tasks. And I think that is a fundamentally different notion of work, because it turns things into work that were previously not work, or certainly not in a way that we've understood. And it desystematizes work, which then has all sorts of consequences, I think, for the broader ecology of working life, even if you can point to people who benefit from doing that work, which is the counter-argument you will always run into when you mount criticisms of the gig economy. Mm. So I think there is a distinction here that's important to acknowledge, because I've got a feeling whatever criticisms you want to launch at the gig economy won't sit quite as naturally if you then try to extend them to other things simply because they're not based on concrete assets such as a Microsoft.
I accept the distinction as a pause between the two, and I think that pause is important and it's substantial. But I don't think you should overplay the distinction between these. I mean, the gig economy is the realization, it seems to me, of a particular historical logic in capitalism itself. Let me take your Zygmunt Bauman and raise you a Slavoj Žižek. I mean, one of the analyses, I think, of what he described as late modern capitalism that I've always found quite interesting is similar to Bauman's, I think, in many respects. If you think about, say, the great multinational, especially, say, fashion conglomerations, where what you primarily own is the brand, you outsource the labor to the cheapest laborers, you outsource the advertisers, the advertising to an advertising firm, you outsource the design to, you know, aesthetic designers, or artists, what you have left effectively is the brand. And it's the brand that then tends to accumulate all of the appropriate profit. And here's where I think you do have the connection with the gig economy. Something like AirTasker or Uber, they don't own very many assets. What they in fact do is they force those who work under or within their platform to become both labor and capital. Now that, I think, Waleed, that's where and the profit is then extracted from that pool of assets as workers. And I think there's
I know the point you're making, but it's different because they're not even offering a good or a service. Really, all they're offering is a platform by which you can access goods and services provided by somebody else.
Yes.
That I think is different to the Microsoft example. There, I mean, we might end up in the weeds here, but what we have clearly identified is that this is the gig economy, at least, is a fundamentally different way of thinking about our economic life.
Mm-hmm.
And it is highly geared towards consumer experience as the dominant or perhaps even only logic that is to prevail. And the highest value, I suppose, that prevails here is things to do with convenience and flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And convenience and flexibility are probably, I haven't thought about this in depth, but off the top of my head, probably antonyms of things like predictability and security.
Yes.
which are things that keep you rooted within a social context and perhaps even an economic context. And there are all kinds of social flow-on effects of that that I think we can be inattendant to, although I do note that things are starting to turn in the way that we think about the gig economy, and this show, this episode, is perhaps evidence of that.
Yeah, let me just say, though, and I think you're absolutely right when you contrast convenience and flexibility with stability. And it's just worth pointing out that whenever you have that kind of benefit accruing to the consumer, that they can get something that they want, when they want it, at a lower price than was previously offered by, say, an established industry with regulatory, with certain regulatory insight.
And unions.
Oversight. And unions, yeah. Then someone has to bear the cost. And that cost is increasingly being borne by workers who are having to short sell themselves and to undervalue their own labor in order to compensate for the fact that the platforms for which they work are rapidly becoming monopolistic. So that the competition that's happening is no longer between, say, overarching companies, but now it's the workers themselves who are having to short sell themselves in order to compete with other workers within the same company or under the same platform.
In the meantime, the profits accrue to the people who are doing the least.
Exactly. So that's exactly right.
It's a kind of rent seeking. Mm. So I'm with you on all of that. For the sake of airing the opposite argument, which I personally don't agree with, but which is always thrown at me when I have these arguments with my friends about it, that isn't the reality for the people who, for example, provide their services on Airtasker. So if I were to think back to my university days, I could have a really low-paid job working at some fast food chain or other, or manning supermarket checkouts and be paid nothing, or I could actually earn twice as much running around picking things up from mm-hmm. hardware stores for people, or moving furniture with my mate who I get to spend time with, and in the meantime I get fit, or whatever it is. That is, I can give you umpteen stories of people whose working life is far more lucrative and even far more rewarding than it would have been the case in previous generations before the gig economy existed.
Mm. Yep.
Do you want to answer, or should we bring in our guest?
Let's bring it out. You've raised so much that I think it's right to the heart of the issue.
Including not thinking systemically about these things. But that's everything. You're listening to The Minefield. It's a show on the radio machine. You may or may not know that. You may be listening to the radio machine right now on Radio National. But if you're not, you can catch it by subscribing to our podcast. You can do that wherever you listen to podcasts. And it comes with a little extra content at the end, because we normally don't get to everything we want to get to in the course of the radio show.
We never get to everything we want to get to.
No, we don't. And even in the podcast bit, eventually they just cut the lines and we have to stop. You can also listen via the ABC Listen app, where you will hear wonderful guests like this.
Yes, indeed. Our guest on today's show is Sarah Kane. She's Associate Professor in the UTS Business School. Thank you so much for joining us on The Minefield, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So look, neither Waleed and I or I are necessarily Luddites. We certainly aren't.
I probably am.
Yeah. Maybe but I think we both border on techno-pessimism. Let's just put it that way.
Definitely.
And so my eyes roll back in my head as soon as I sort of hear people begin to wax lyrical about these wonderful new digital platforms, how this has changed everything, that curmudgeons just need to sort of catch up with this brave new world that these digital platforms have brought in. But it seems to me, and maybe you disagree strongly with everything that Waleed and I have just been discussing, but it seems to me that where we are at the moment with this transformation of work, this has not come out of a vacuum, and it's certainly not been the product of digital platforms, that this is coming out of a certain logic within capitalism, or even the decline of other countervailing economic or corporatist forces. Do you want to say something about where the gig economy comes from?
Yeah, I do. And first, I'd just say that I think a good dose of techno-pessimism probably is in order to balance things up a little bit. And I too worry a bit that technology and platforms and digital disruption is kind of seen as the beginning and the end of this debate. And as you say, it's really the continuation of what we've seen going on. So I guess I do like to challenge that sort of technological determinism, if you like, and sort of place what's happening in the context of sort of economic and labour market reforms. I'm very much interested in that labour side of things, that have taken place over the past 30 years. So if we think about changes in work in Australia over that time, we have seen, I heard Willie talk about commodification, we have seen an increase in commodification of work. We have seen the breakdown of, you know, full-time work. We've seen an increase in contracting and casual work. So this is at the current version or the current manifestation of what has been a longer-term trend that has played out both in the economy, but of course in politics and the discourse around work, which has turned very much more towards the idea of flexibility, which I'm always a bit worried about because I'm not entirely sure that we articulate flexibility for whom and who benefits from it. So I would very much place what's happening with the gig economy as a kind of follow-on from what we've seen happen with regards to work in Australia in the past 20 to 30 years.
As we've seen, for example, in the controversy that surrounded work choices when John Howard tried to introduce it, ultimately cost him his job and his seat in the 2007 election, which I think raises an interesting point because it does show that when things are presented to us in this way, I mean, work choices was the legislative embodiment or distillation of the idea of flexibility,
yeah,
right? And yet when it was presented to us in legislative form, we revolted as a nation. The union movement ran a very successful campaign. The Labor Party ran a very successful campaign, in part because it was tapping into concerns and resentment that were there. But on this, it's taken us a lot longer to get to the point of being concerned even. And even though we might be concerned and have misgivings about the use of these services, it's just easier to catch an Uber sometimes, and we will just go and order Uber Eats because that's just easier than having to go out to a takeaway place and get some food or whatever if we don't have time to cook. So we're still using this, and I wonder if the thing that is active here is the frame through which we view the world. And the continuity you're talking about is not just in policy terms, it's also in discursive terms. Mm. It's in the fact that we are becoming increasingly trained to view the world through the eyes of being a consumer.
Mm.
Because if you are a consumer, there is no argument really that can be raised against the gig economy other than, in the long run, there'll probably be a monopoly that'll end up costing you a lot more money or something like that, some version of that. But as long as everything is a consumer story, we actually have no way of even grasping the concept of the gig economy.
Look, I think that's true. And I think that the consumer convenience is, you know, a very compelling when you think about all the digital disruption that we've seen and been party to, I guess. But I also think we shouldn't underplay that there has also been a shift in probably individual expectations of work as well. So you talk about the work choices changes. And of course, you know, John Howard was ultimately defeated on that. But that did shift. What happened still caused a shift in our expectations of work, so that we have, you know, when I look at my students, they will have very different expectations that this discourse about flexibility and the types of services they consume will have informed. So they won't even be looking necessarily for the same types of work that we would have thought or would have expected.
Well, so what's the problem then? I mean, if our expectations have shifted, we're more or less comfortable with those expectations, I would presume. So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is that ignores all of the costs associated with that. So if we only focus on, you know, consumer convenience, and that, you know, it plays in with this alternative shaping of our expectations, we're missing out on the costs, which ultimately will need to be paid. And the way I think of that is that the costs of the gig economy are at three levels. So at the micro level, we have costs to individual workers who will be out there performing gig jobs that, on the whole, the types of jobs that we're looking at don't attract the same wages and conditions as non-gig jobs. And we know that even for Uber drivers, that the simulations of their pay show that they're getting less than they would under a comparative award. So there's that individual cost that will be paid in terms of the acceptance of lower standards, which will impact on individuals' quality of life. Then, of course, there's the mezzo, if you like, the costs, which are at an industry level, which are organisations that are investing investing in their workers, that are attempting to be socially responsible in terms of giving fair wages and conditions, are undercut by organisations that come in and essentially seek to circumvent existing regulation. And then, of course, significantly, even for those of us who don't engage in the gig economy at all, either as workers or as consumers, we will ultimately pay sort of the social costs of having an increasing cohort of workers who don't have access to superannuation, who don't have the other kind of social benefits associated with being in a more standard job. And that's a much slower burn that, as a taxpayer, whether I, you know, take Ubers or whether I use Deliveroo, I will be paying for into the future. So when you say, does it matter? Well, it does, but I'm not sure that we've been clearly articulating those levels of costs.
I want to pick up something, though, that Waleed mentioned before, just before we introduced you, Sarah, and this is about the monetization, if you like, of chores. The fact that people are simply being paid to do fairly menial stuff.
And jobs that didn't exist in any other form.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, yeah.
But see, here's where, again, Waleed, you're probably going to sort of hate me for continuing to draw these connections, but I really do think the connections need to be drawn. We're seeing much the same thing with the contractualization of labor, where someone's total body of expertise, who they are as a worker, and the extent to which they contribute to the ethos, to the culture of a company as a whole, and the extent to which their work is actually part of the larger task of sociality itself. That, too, is being destroyed by turning workers into not workers as such, but simply contractual employees. This, I think, is the great unanalyzed thing, that what we're witnessing here is the atomization of tasks so that the people who then perform those tasks are simply the bearers of particular forms of labor. I mean, don't you think, Sarah, that there is a kind of...
Sorry, as opposed to what? Can I just get you to clarify that?
Well, I mean, as opposed to seeing work as something that bears a dignity in and of itself.
There's an invisibility about atomization.
Yes.
And it's worse for different types of gig work or tasks, if you like. So Amazon Turk, which is the sort of micro task online platform, is called Amazon Turk because it was named after Amazon Mechanical Turk. It was named after a so-called automated chess playing machine from about the mid 1700s, I think, where a small person was put inside a machine and manipulated the chess pieces as if it was automated, so that the person playing thought they were playing against an automated machine.
Yeah.
But behind that box, as it was at the time, was human labour. And so Amazon Mechanical Turk is named after this. So it's explicitly trying to make invisible the work that people perform. And why, again, does that matter, which is a fair question, is that that devalues the work that people do. And if you think that these tasks are often, you know, 5 cents a task, etc., it's very hard for people to cobble together a reasonable equivalent of a wage based on that kind of work. So I think that's really important. But if we're also talking about consumer demand, Waleed, and I hear that that's where you're kind of going with this. There's the story, I don't know if you heard of the app, and I'm pretty sure it was called Pooper, pardon my language, in the US.
God,
did you hear about
this?
Yeah.
Is this the nappy changing thing?
No, even worse than that. Oh, because I may have used that service, I've got to say. If that had been available, I might have been up for that. Now, this was some marketing execs came together and looked at the gig economy and were basically having a bit of a joke. And so they decided that what they would do is put together a gig company, a fake gig company that was about picking up, you know, your dog poop on the streets. And so they launched it to a lot of, you know, they sort of launched what was a fake attempt, this thing called Pooper, where it was if you took a photo of your dog's business, that some gig worker would come along and pick it up for you.
And it took off, right?
Well, the really fascinating thing is, and this is where it really starts to challenge, I think, this idea of it, this is consumer-driven. The really interesting thing is, of course, they got a lot of publicity about it until someone kind of twigged, like, is this actually for real?
Real, yeah.
That they got a lot of interest from from not so many much people wanting to use the service, but of those people who wanted to work for the service. So they had more contact from people who were in such a position in the labour market that they felt that picking up the poop of other people's dogs was something that they would engage in.
Well, what a note on which to end the radio portion of the show. We'll be back with Sarah Kane, Associate Professor in the UTS Business School, for the podcast element of The Mindfield next. So we're here with Sarah Kane, Associate Professor in the UTS Business School, to continue this conversation, which I think ended very delicately on pooper.
Sorry about that.
Well, it's funny because the example that I only heard about this yesterday was in the UK, where someone had they launched the idea of a nappy changing service. So you would just they would send someone to come over and change nappies for you. They did it as an April Fool's joke, and they got so much demand that they ended up launching it for real. It's like, which is the opposite of your story, because your story is about this being driven from people who, where the workplace has changed so much that there are people who actually think this is a good option for them to be doing this.
Exactly.
Whereas this was actually driven by consumer demand. But it does show the effortlessness with which we think about these sorts of things, and the way that this is all changing and our easy acceptance of that at a certain level. But I do wonder whether or not there's a certain romanticism going on in the way that we're talking about it. So, for example, is the sweatshop worker who makes our clothes within a context that is anything but flexible, anything but embodiment of the gig economy, is that person visible to us any more than the sort of invisible labour of someone who drives around doing deliveries or delivering food or whatever it might be, or running errands for people? Is the factory worker who performs some menial task over and over and over again in a thoroughly mechanised process that produces a good that is standard issue, effectively machine-made, is that person visible to us? And have they been visible to us, particularly once the unions stopped being a major player in politics and they weren't represented that way? Like, I just wonder whether or not looking at the gig economy as though it embodies some kind of newly dehumanising thing is particularly compelling, given that I think there's been a lot of dehumanising aspects to the way that we do work.
I think you're exactly right, and I think that there are a lot of concerning aspects to a lot of work that's undertaken, you know, whether it's locally or internationally. I don't know that provides a rationale for accepting that, you know, the undermining of broader conditions is okay because we see, you know, not great things happening in other circumstances, that then allows for us to accept what is the undermining of conditions in the gig economy. So I'm not entirely sure that would be a logical argument as far as I'm concerned.
Well, but it says that disruption, this idea of disruption, is not really the appropriate focus here. Mm,
exactly.
No, I think it's new technology that is bringing to light old challenges, which is about dignity at work. It's about fairness. It's about what is the function of work? Is it simply that economic exchange? Is there, you know, what is the psychological or social context around work as well? So I think the new technology is refocusing us in a different way on those old challenges, which manifest in different ways in different industries in different countries.
The concept of dignity is complex, though, Scott, I reckon.
It is.
Because from what do you derive that dignity? So is turning up to do a menial task day after day, but being represented by a union that has solidarity and gives you a place within, say, the cultural or political imagination, is that dignified in a way that, for example, self-directing your own work by performing menial tasks on your time and at your convenience, I suppose, and at your decision, which is the more dignified way of working?
Look, I mean, there are very particular conditions, I think, under which work can be called dignified or even humanising. I mean, when somebody, and believe it or not, Waleed, I actually find that the counter-argument that you've made for why this shouldn't be considered a disruption at all, I actually think that's been incredibly powerful as a way of saying that there is, in fact, perhaps not a moral equivalence between a kind of instrumentalisation of human labour or the hollowing out of workers' rights within workplaces and the gig economy, but at least there is a kind of family resemblance between them. There is something fundamentally similar about what's going on. I think one of the important things, though, is to see the work that one does, and this is how I would define dignity in and of work, to see the work that one does as inherently connected to oneself and one's sense of self, but also conscious in the sense that the work that I am doing is actually part of my own sense of virtue, who I am as a worker, who I am as someone who belongs to a particular social or political community, but who also sees within that process of work something that I am in fact contributing to the larger or the wider social good. In other words, as soon as work is cut off from myself, and here let me, Sarah kind of opened up the floodgates here with a reference to poop. Let me sort of do something similarly indelicate. As soon as one understands one's body as effectively being hired out for the performance of certain tasks for which I may then emotionally, vocationally distance myself, as soon as I effectively prostitute myself, if you like, to the larger economy, that's where I think the notion of dignity gets lost from work altogether. And can I just point out, there's one family resemblance here that we haven't drawn a connection to. There is another form, of course, of capitalism that also erased the boundary between capital and labor, that made the bodies of people the things that were being traded, the forms of value. And that, of course, was racial capitalism, otherwise known as slavery. So I think here's where we need to keep kind of stitching together those various historical and economic connections.
So hang on, could I ask you this though? Where would a professional athlete sit in the scheme that you've painted?
A professional athlete now, where they are their own product, where they have their own brand managers, I think modern sports stars, competitors, are very much part of precisely the same malaise, whereas those who belong more organically or richly to a team, to a nation, those who are involved more productively in, say, a team or collective bargaining, that I think is where you have something that truly could be called dignity.
Still selling their bodies, though.
But I think a key issue here, really, whether you're taking the elite sports person or whether you're going back to thinking of workers on the shop floor, the key variable for me here is power. And an elite sports person has a degree of power that a delivery rider does not. And a collective group of workers has power to change the conditions, power to have a say, power to withdraw labour en masse that an individual in the lower skilled, and I think we need to differentiate between, we've always had contracting and independent contracting and freelancing in your more skilled areas, and that will continue, and many people like that kind of work. But I think the concept of power is missing. And so your elite sportsman has power, her has power to do that. Individuals do not.
A lot of them don't. I mean, a lot of them are in very precarious situations, aren't they? They're one injury away from losing their livelihood, or they're, the decision of one manager or coach away from being cut off because they don't fit the mold of a particular coaching philosophy of that moment or whatever. I mean, I understand what you're saying. In theory, I grasp the idea of power as a centrally relevant concept, and might lead us to conclude something that, could be useful, like the gig economy is fine for those who are empowered economically and socially, but it becomes really bad where you're dealing with people who lack that power. The only concern I have with that formulation is that I think the concept of power is a very slippery one. It's not a very straightforward linear one. Those who seem empowered are often not, or they are precariously empowered.
Except, Waleed, I would disagree. I would say we've historically come to understand, and we're experiencing in Australia, the wage stagnation that comes from a situation where collective groups of workers don't have power to negotiate. So in terms of making power a bit more concrete in terms of the labour market, we understand what power means and what it does in terms of broader economic circumstances. So I get that overall it's quite an elusive concept, but we actually understand what power in the workforce, what power in the workplace means and what consequences it does have if it's there, and it doesn't if it's not there.
What I'm asking, though, is anyone empowered in the workplace? So take, for example, what did you say? Skilled labour or skilled tasks, right, that are subject to contract work or economies, right? Take, for example, august presenters at the ABC like Scott Stevens. Is he powerful, or will he discover just how powerless he is when a new manager takes over who just for some vague reason doesn't like the cut of his jib.
Well, of course. And this is, and I guess this is the point too about the wherever contracting is individualised, there is always going to be the possibility that, you know, someone doesn't like the look of you and your contract isn't continued. I guess it's the alternatives that more educated workers have and more skilled workers have to go and find something else that also, I guess, colours the debate around this. So while Scott's new manager might not like him, Scott's equipped to go and find something relatively similar in the future.
But the argument is that the gig economy provides that alternative as well. I mean, they go and perform a different set of gigs.
Yes, with a higher degree of precarity for those who can least afford it. So, yes, in that sense, there is the flexibility. And there's always, I mean, you haven't needed the gig economy for employers and managers to use the argument, if you don't want to work here, there's lots of other places you can go to work. That is not a new argument.
Mm. Interesting. Look, there are just two things that I'd like to add here, given the fact that, you know, my name has been so freely thrown around. I mean, it is interesting, Waleed, the point that you raise, I think, is a nice demonstration of the extent to which work can and should be considered as dignified or as an expression of human. I mean, I'm not quite so enamored with the notion of power, but I think the notion of agency, the fact that I am in fact participating in something in which I find a degree of value through which I see myself contributing to something bigger and better than myself. I think it's that progression within work. And, you know, throughout the history of the philosophy and theology of work, there has been this sense of almost a kind of lifetime apprenticeship, the working from fairly menial tasks through which I'm acquiring specific virtues through to far more skilled tasks, where the extent to which I am an agent within some wider good is more apparent to me and to others. So I think that's actually a very nice demonstration of how it is that work might be considered dignified. Let me just raise, though, the big elephant in the room. I mean, one of the things that I think we've neglected, if things have been changing for the better part of four decades when it comes to workers' conditions, and if the gig economy is just the latest instantiation of that, and if there's very little sense that we might be going back, are there conditions under which a certain degree of stability, which is lacking at the moment, could in fact be provided? So, for instance, it's been interesting to me that some political philosophers who have been looking at the gig economy have been saying this is a wonderful argument for the introduction of something like the universal basic income, where the precarity of the gig economy, the lack of benefits, of employees' rights, is ameliorated somewhat by the provision of some baseline under which a worker cannot fall, which means that I really am empowered to do those tasks that I want to do, and that the flexibility that I'm then afforded as a worker isn't at the expense of long-term stability.
I was going to let you jump in, Sarah, but I'm happy to respond if you like. Well, I think what is abundantly clear is that if the gig economy is more or less an irreversible phenomenon. So it is, as we've been discussing, the logical extension of a decades-long process that is not about to be turned around in an instant. Then we clearly have to reimagine in a very fundamental way our relationship to work, our relationship to government payments, welfare, subsistence, all of that sort of stuff. I have concerns with the universal basic income. Just the cost of it and the mechanism of it. I'm just not convinced that it would do a better job than current welfare systems of trying to allow people to subsist and without exacerbating inequalities anyway. But what I do like about its introduction in the conversation is that it does point to the need for some kind of radical reordering of things if we're going to keep proceeding down this path, because of course all the previous welfare systems and subsistence systems we've dreamed up have been in the context of a very different economic logic, and if we're going to change that economic and even social logic, then there has to be a concomitant policy change. I just don't know that anyone's really figured out what it is.
My concern about the discussion of the universal basic income to date is that it seems to be have come at the expense of thinking about other options for countering the development of precarious work. I mean, we used to think some time ago about creating jobs and the role of the state in creating jobs, and we could think of that in a much more creative way and about what would be socially meaningful, publicly funded jobs rather than necessarily a welfare type payment, which I think is politically problematic in Australia, where we still have very much the idea of the dole bludger, or you know, the leaners who rely on welfare. Yeah. So I think it's very politically problematic, this concept of a universal basic income in Australia.
Especially given we've just heard that wages are starting to come back, but when you dig into the data, it's really just on the back of government jobs, not private sector jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. Sarah, we could keep going forever and ever and ever, I've got a feeling. That wouldn't help the world very much, but we would enjoy it. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to do so. But thank you very much for helping us out today. It's been great.
Thank you so much.